listener production.
Okay, are you recording?
Howdy, legends. Welcome along to episode 152 of the Howie Games Part A. Hope you are having a ripping day wherever you're tuning in. This one features AFL superstar Nick Riewoldt.
Riewoldt from 45. Coming back, and he's got nine. His equal best ever in a stellar career.
Now, Rui, as he's universally known, had a career backed by glittering statistics. Check these out. He was the number one draft pick. He won six St Kilda Best and Fairest, six, five All-Australians. He won the Rising Star Award, played 336 games, 220 as captain, kicked 718 goals, and on and on and on the numbers go. But as impressive as those statistics are, they probably still don't do Nick's career justice. They do not tell the story of an athlete who pushed himself physically way beyond the accepted levels of AFL footballers. They don't tell the story of a captain who went out every game with Saints fans hanging on the sentence, tell you what, if Rui plays well today, I reckon we'll win. They don't tell the story of a man who beat himself up mercilessly if he couldn't meet his own ultra-high standards, or of a player who sacrificed everything, and I mean everything, as you're about to find out, to win the premiership, but whose team fell three times at the final hurdle. Those numbers do not tell any of those stories. Now, you'll hear Nick in this chat talk about how his drive for perfection on the footy field made him not enjoy parts of his football journey. And in many ways, it made him a different person to who he really is. But in no way, shape or form, and I stress this, in no way does this mean that Nick didn't love the game and what it gave him. He's grateful. He still loves footy, which he's now seeing through the eyes of his boys, which is really cool. But his intensity, his drive, his passion all made the game much more than a game for Nick. I guess that's probably why he was so good.
So you search and try to find, but you don't know where to go. So many thoughts flood through your mind, you're confused and want to know. Mystery, what is to be? So much more than meets the eye. Listen to me, time is your key. You will find out by and by.
Now, I've been really fortunate to get to know Nick a little whilst working beside him at Fox Footy the last couple of years, and get to know him a lot in the last few months when we've been working together with him starring on Fox Footy's new Saturday night show, Best on Ground. Check it out straight after the footy on Saturday nights. Let me know what you think. Give me some feedback. Rui is good fun to be around. He's always enthusiastic. He's really generous with his time and compliments all those around him. But what has really struck me about Nick is his want to improve. He wants to learn. He wants to get better as a football media person. He goes back. He reviews his work. He watches the show, thinks about how he can get better. He asks lots of questions, what he can do to improve the team. It is really, really cool to see. In a nutshell, Nick wants to be the best he can be. And I guess that's the key to success right there, isn't it?
So many lost and left behind, and no one seemed to care. Those who should seems like they're blind, pretending they're not there. Can't they see they hold the key? Could make things better if they try. Oh my Jaja, tell me why won't they open up their eyes?
This is not so much a footy chat. It wanders through books, mental preparation, cooking. There's a love story in there. There's a heartbreaking story. There's all sorts of stories. You will hear about Nick's sister, Maddie, in this episode. If you would like to donate to help raise money for Maddie Riewoldt's vision, to fund the medical research that will lead to new treatments and cures for bone marrow failure syndrome, all you need to do is hit up mrv.org.au. That is mrv.org.au. Anything you can spare will be really, really appreciated. Thanks. Enjoy the story of a man who wants to be better tomorrow than he is today, Nick Riewoldt.
So when you search and then you find, and know just where to go, and thoughts that once used to cloud your mind, you see clearly and now you know. Mystery, what is to be revealed in King Selassie I. Come on children, trot with me, we want to reach Mount Zion I.
Wow, welcome to the Howie Games. This man, 336 games for the Saints, 718 goals, six BNFs, five All-Australians. I'm not sure how much football we're going to talk with him, though, which will entertain me knowing his name is Nick Riewoldt, and he joins us on the pod in person, which is outstanding. Big man, how are you?
Good, mate. I'm good. It's been a treat last few weeks. Spent a bit of time together.
We've started a new TV show together, which we'll get to, Best on Ground. We have spent a bit of time in the last month, and the thing I've noticed about you that I didn't necessarily think would be the case, you're a very tactile man. You're a big hugger.
Personal Space Invader.
I like it.
Yeah,
I like it.
It's a lot of people don't.
Well, you and another fella called Gus Wallen that I know, you two could have a hug off. Like, he has to hug people. Have you always been a hugger?
Yes, I've always been very tactile.
I wouldn't have picked that from you.
Wouldn't you?
No.
Yeah.
No, but we only saw part of you, which I'm beginning to understand.
That's true. Well, the part you saw on the footy field, is not the real version.
No.
It was that was the disguise. But I am, I drove teammates, I drove a lot of people crazy.
With the hugs?
With the hugs, with the constant need for just touching.
And
it hasn't got me in trouble, which is good.
No, but you're a big touchy-feely guy.
Which, I am.
So right off the top then, how long have you been retired now?
5.
Okay, so how much of the last 5 years is about you trying to show people that you are not the bloke that was on the football field for St Kilda?
Yeah, a bit. And so, I mean, the only way that you really get to show the same audience is through the media lens,
yes.
I guess, isn't
yes.
it? So that has been a challenge probably up until more recently. So because you come straight out and you're fresh out of the game, and so your great asset from a media point of view is your knowledge of the game. So that's the role you play. But probably the last couple of years, I think once you become that little bit more removed, which I have, and then more opportunities open up, the opportunity to show a little bit of personality. I mean, I've almost been begging at times for the opportunity to show
who you are.
Some of my very limited personality, Howie.
Because
I feel like I was a certain way the whole time I played footy. Like, I had the serious head on. Like, when I first started doing AFL 360, when I came off and I got to know Robbo and Jared, they were a little bit surprised that I was the way I was because they had this preconception of me because of what they'd seen on the footy field. And Robbo said to me, "You had a resting bitch face for 17 years." You know, and I know the scowl. I can feel it when it creeps in. But that's just how I was or needed to be while I was playing footy. Like, very serious, wound up the whole time, always on, could never relax. And I didn't actually really enjoy that part of it that much.
No.
Didn't necessarily enjoy who I was and that persona. Now, it served me well from a performance point of view.
That's the question. I didn't expect to dive straight into this.
Yeah.
But we'll get later on to idiosyncrasies.
I
sort of said this to you the other day, and we sort of had a brief chat about this. If you hadn't been who you were on the footy field, would I have been able to read out those numbers and the level of performance and your status in the game if that wasn't you?
I ask myself that question a lot.
Yeah, and what's your answer?
I don't know. I don't know is the answer. I mean, I think you are who you are, and I couldn't manufacture that for that long. It just wouldn't have worked. And the same the other way, I think if I had have tried to manufacture a loosey-goosey, laissez-faire type attitude, a little bit like my cousin.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, he's almost the antithesis of me, isn't he? And it drives me crazy. Like, it actually does it.
Your cousin's Jack Revolt, for those that don't know.
My cousin Jack Revolt, who's had a very, very successful career with premierships and stuff, and he's had that lighthearted attitude the whole way through. I just couldn't go there. Like, it just didn't happen that way for me. And that's okay. Like, I don't really have any regrets from that point of view, but you never know. I mean, I might have, if I took that approach, my whole career might have blown up early.
So
Did
you look at those, and you would have had teammates like that, and did you look at those blokes and think, "Oh, I wish I could be more like that"? Or did you look at those blokes and think, "Are they fair dinkum? We're about to play a game of footy here"?
Both.
Okay.
Both. I had a moment. There was a late in my career where Lee Montagna was one of my very, very good mates. Batman and Robin type relationship. I'll let you work out who was Batman.
It wasn't Joey. He's not your Batman type. He's your second in the cast.
That's the one. He was singing the opposition theme song in the warm-up.
Right.
And, just cruising around and doing what he does, because he was one of those very relaxed customers. Game day, day before the game. And I looked at him and I said, "Mate, are you serious?" Like, it actually pissed me off. I'm like, get your head into gear. I couldn't understand how guys could be so relaxed. Once the ball was bounced away, perfect, no worries. Like, game on. But the lead up had me in knots. And that's why I was the way I was for 17 years.
I can recall countless times on the wireless on Triple M being on the boundary and interviewing you in the St Kilda room, and it was never a light-hearted style of interview. You were always, and that was post-game, and if I was in your rooms, you would have won as well, but it was always reasonably serious.
Yeah.
But I can also recall, and I brought this up with you the other day, in Jack's first year, we did a rising star story, and you guys, which we'll get to, from Tassie into the water, and I somehow managed to get a yacht from someone, and we went out sailing for the day.
Sure, it wasn't yours?
No, it wasn't mine. It wasn't mine. It's a long time ago. It definitely wasn't mine.
A different story now, Howie.
I could have chosen three for you now, but completely different story. No, but and it was you and Jack, and it was Jack's first year, and you were relaxed then, but I remember the boom swung around at one point, and you ducked, and I remember thinking, oh my God, what if he'd been knocked overboard? What would he have said to Ross Lyon? But Jack said something right at the end, and I put it in the story, and I don't know it word for word, but I think you might have been playing each other in a couple of weeks. And he's in his first year, and he said something about, he didn't even call them the Tigers. He's like, I reckon the Tiggies will get the job done over the Saints. And he just started laughing, and it was immediately obvious. Related, cousins, both very different approach to what they're doing.
Yeah, and that's true.
Not wrong or right.
No, that's it. There's no wrong or right with any of that stuff. And I would love to have been the other way, because I feel like the whole experience would have been more enjoyable at times. But the light and the shade of coming out and now being on the other side of it, like I love the fact that I'm not playing anymore.
Yes.
Because it's great. It's fun. And footy was fun. Like, don't get me wrong. It wasn't this horrible thing that I had to endure for 17 years. Like I loved it. And the game was great to me. I'm so grateful for the whole thing. But being on the other side of it is great. It's refreshing, because I'm just not I don't feel like I'm wired the same way anymore.
And we'll talk to shortly about how the game was for you and how you had to prepare for it. But the moment that I went home and said to my wife, Erica, we were doing a game with Gary Lyon a few weeks ago at the MCG, and I said, Nick, we've got a lot in common. And she, why is that? I said, because we started talking about books.
Mm.
And I wanted to talk about books at the start. And I've just given you a big, big, fat book by Ken Follett called Never, which I found on my recent holidays. But you immediately put me on to some more books of his. So I've started reading. So what's it called?
The trilogy?
Yeah, the trilogy.
I think it's called the Millennium.
Right.
Millennium Trilogy.
Outstanding.
So Fall of Giants first.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So before we get into it, you say you found it on holidays. Are you ever going to come clean? Or?
Well, I was in a unit and I read 10 pages of it, and I said, I can't put this down. But it was in the unit that we were staying. But we did leave a book. So it was a book swap.
But they don't know about it.
Well, no, they don't know about it. But they've probably read that book. And but the only thing is, their book's an 850-page sucker called Never, and I left him one of
each. I do notice a few doggies in the book here. I wonder if old mate's going to come back, and he's up to chapter 9, and it's just not there anymore.
Because what he's got in return is a 250-page chick lit that E was reading on her holiday. So it's very different. Talk to me about books. I recommended to you The Alchemist.
Yeah.
Have you finished it?
Finished it.
What did you think?
Deep.
Deep?
Deep. I really enjoyed it. Like, it was... wasn't what I expected at the start, where it feels like he's going to go on a bit of a journey. And I think the thing that brief plot summary, young shepherd meets someone who basically sends him on this journey to discover a treasure. And it's his personal
legend.
So that's what this journey is called. And everyone's got a personal legend. It's about whether you actually embrace it and take it on or not.
Follow your dreams.
No. And he takes it on. And what resonated with me was he went through this whole experience, and spoiler alert.
No, don't.
Okay, but what resonated with me was, I think, like, at times life feels like it's always, where's the next destination? What's next? What's next? What's next? And I'm wired that way.
Yep.
Served me really well as a footballer. Probably in life it's a little bit hard to live in the moment at times. So for me, that's what it was all about. It was about the journey being as important as the destination. And that's really what I took away from it. So I really enjoyed it.
I'm glad. So now, never done this on the show. Often in a player profile, we talk about books, but let's do Howie and Rui sort of favourite book style book review.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Give me a couple. You did give me a couple.
I gave you a couple.
I hadn't necessarily read them all.
So the Ken Follett trilogy. So there's the Pillars of the Earth, which is sort of a bit more medieval.
Is that where they're building the church?
Building the church.
I haven't read that one yet. So you're recommending that?
They're good.
But tell me about a cowboy one.
Lonesome Dove. Larry McMurdy is the author. And it's about a couple of cowboys in deep South Texas. They nip across the border. They wrangle some horses and some cattle. And then they drive them north, and they're on the march to basically go up and establish, like the series Yellowstone,
right,
an old style ranch. But we're talking, you know, back in the 1800s. So you know, Indians, Native Americans everywhere, and it's pretty full on. But it's a thick.
As thick as that one.
It's as thick as this one.
Right. So it's a bit daunting.
Meaty. Daunting when you pick it up. You need big wrists to be able to flick
when you're reading in bed.
You need big wrists. It's almost a little bit too cumbersome to get through.
Like
but it's an absolute beauty. So that's Lonesome Dove. I mean,
we both agreed. Power of the Dog.
Power of the Dog.
Don Winslow. Right. If you're looking for a book recommendation from me, read anything from Don Winslow. But The Power of the Dog.
Which threw me off because that movie that was up for the Oscar, Power of the Dog, and I was like, they made a movie? Unbelievable.
I only got 2/3 of that way through. I didn't enjoy that at all,
but the movie.
But it's completely separate.
It's not the same story. Yes. So I was a little bit
The other one you brought up to me, and I can't remember what it was called, and I couldn't believe you'd read it, was the one about vampires, and I don't know how I ended up with it. The 10 or the 12 or
the 12's the second one.
Right.
The first one was The Passage.
The Passage.
Justin Cronin.
Oh. Yeah. Elite book.
Very good book.
Elite book. It's about vampires.
It's about vampires, like post-apocalyptic vampire. And it's not Twilight.
If I knew that's what it was about, I would have never picked it up.
You wouldn't.
Saying that Lost Boys is one of my favourite films of all time.
Yep.
But if I remember saying this to someone. I tried to get a different book and I thought that was it and got it confused. I was like, I'll read a couple of pages, couldn't put it down.
Well, your first 200 pages is present day.
Yes.
You know, and then all hell breaks loose and the world
and
comes to an end, and then you flip forward a couple of millennia and we're living in a different world. It's very good. Three books. Really, really enjoyed that one. I mean, Shantaram's a
great book.
A ripper.
Are they making that into a movie? We might do a sort of book movie review podcast from moving on. That is a good book. Yeah, there was another one that we both read. Not Origin. No, I should.
I got a logo.
The one with the finger, the thumbprint on the front cover.
I Am Pilgrim,
Nick Riewoldt. Bang! Good book.
Yeah, good book.
Good book.
Really good book. That's so more your Jason Bourne type.
Yes. Good book.
Yeah, so someone like a Jason Bourne type trying to find this terrorist that's trying to bring about the end of the world. Really good.
Good book.
Really good. Orphan X is another one that's just similar, along a similar vein. You haven't read it?
No.
That's good. I'm just flicking. I'm looking for my little list. Did I flick you through my list? I can't remember.
An insight into how organised your life is, because you had a book list. I got another one for you.
What do you got?
People might not have heard this. I put my mum onto it. She loved it. It's called The Terror.
Haven't read it.
Said in the mid-1800s, blokes get marooned in the Arctic on a boat.
Okay.
And there's a bit of a supernatural feel to it. But where's this love of reading come from? Were you a reader as a kid? Did you read when you played? Do you read at night time now? You got a young family.
Read at night. Try to make that a, you know, an every night type thing.
I didn't expect it. I don't know why. When we started talking about books, I would have never picked you as a reader.
Yeah, either lay there on your phone or you lay there and read a book.
Yep.
So I've never been big into non-fiction, sort of self-help or biographies, and starting to move a little bit more into that space now. But I've always just been into fiction.
Yes, me too.
I don't know, a bit of an escape, I guess, a distraction. So I did start reading a lot while I was playing, because game day, you know, when you'd get a little bit antsy, to be able to just sit down and read a book for an hour, I felt like was almost a bit of a tool to just be able to kill some time waiting to play a game of footy.
Yeah.
So that was really I wasn't a massive reader as a kid, because I was always playing sport, I guess, but.
And what about reading to your young blokes? Do you do that?
Yeah. Yeah. Love
Magical.
It. And my oldest boy, he's just gotten to the stage where he's starting to be able to sit and read a book by himself. He's 7.
Okay.
So, it's, you know, we've had a few people try to infiltrate. So Gary Lyon sent him Specky McGee, and there's been a bit of that sort of
trying to get the sales up a bit.
It's quite sick, really, when you think about it. Like, come on, mate.
That's just like Commonwealth Bank at primary school trying to get your dollar account.
Yeah, the old Dollamite account. Yeah, weren't they good?
That's it.
The MS Readathon. Yep, that's probably when I would have read back in the MS Readathon.
Lord of the Rings. Have you read Lord of the Rings? Outstanding.
Great.
Right up there. Yep. Top
terrific.
Five for me.
Can't wait to be able to read those books to the kids.
I just got through. It took a year of COVID for me to read, was it 1,170 pages to both my kids, Lord of the Rings. And COVID was a good time because we couldn't go or do anything. And to see, we're getting way off track here, but to see your children embrace something that you love, it's like when they start walking around, you know, imitating Bilbo or Frodo or Gollum, it's a beautiful thing. It's like, I like seeing them play sport, but then to see them get joy out of a book you like or some music you like, it's cool.
It is cool. So circle back to The Alchemist for me, because I haven't spoken to you about it since I finished it.
Right.
And I was interested in your take, because you said you've read it seven times. It's your favourite
book. Well, the weird thing about The Alchemist for me was I was backpacking when I first found it, and I found it in a hostel in Cairo at a book swap. Now, obviously, so much for those that have read the book is about getting to the pyramids.
Right.
So I was going to the pyramids the next day. So it had an immediate connection with me. And I was in that space of traveling and finding out what's around the next corner. And
you're on your own personal ledger.
Yeah, exactly. And it just hit me between the eyes. You know, I was trying to follow my dreams. So I think that's why it's had a massive impact to me. I read it to my kids in Panama. We were on tour in Panama, and they're probably a little bit too young to get it. But to me, whenever I feel like I'm going, this is about you, but whenever I feel like I'm going a little bit off track with getting sucked into, I say this respectfully, too much into work or in other areas of my life that I know are not the central, most important part of my life, I read that book and I'm like, that's where I need to be going.
Yeah. And it's digestible.
Yes.
You can read it. You can bang it out pretty quick. What,
absolutely.
140 pages,
yeah,
maybe.
She's not like Never by Big Ken Follett there.
She's more this style.
Yeah, that's a nice little one. Right, now books.
Okay.
I read your book, The Things That Make Us, Life, Loss and Football. Congratulations. It's a fantastic read. I texted you saying I have so many sport books at home, obviously for podcasts, and I normally scan through them. I read this page for page. I did not skip a word. I love the book. I want to talk to you about parts of the book. But I often start with those discussions about origins. Your family on your father's side has a fascinating background that I had no idea about until I read the book. Just give me a brief idea of the revolts.
Yes.
So I've got to change my commentary. So revolts.
Yeah, soft V. Yeah,
so revolts.
Revolt, yeah.
And how the revolts got to Australia and why they got to Australia. I loved it too, mate. Congratulations on
Thanks,
the book.
Mate.
It's a really, really good book.
Well, I mean, that story was, I guess, part of the motivation for writing a book.
Absolutely.
Because I didn't want to do, because I was never a big reader of autobiographies and so I almost sort of thought it would be hypocritical if I went down that path.
Yep.
So if I did it, I wanted to do something different. I wanted to focus on we're all made up of different things. I mean, we are the way we are because of circumstances, people, events,
experiences.
Places, experiences, all of those things. So these are mine. Actually having the conversation with my grandparents was something that I'd always wanted to do, but I'd never been able to do because don't mention the war.
Right.
Right. So my dad was born in Germany in the 50s. My grandparents were teenagers in Berlin during World War II. So I always knew that they had some pretty amazing stories to tell, and I'd heard bits and pieces, but I never really knew, and they were never really that prepared to talk about it. So when the opportunity to write the book arose, I thought, well, this is the time to go and have the chat. And they're old enough now, they're probably at the point in their lives where they don't really care anymore. They're happy to talk about it. And for perpetuity's sake, let's get it down on paper so that my kids and everyone knows what happened. Because once they're gone, the stories are gone.
Absolutely.
So that was the motivation. And it was a pretty special few hours to actually just sit there, put the tape recorder down, press play, and it's like, tell me this, tell me that, tell me what was it like growing up as a young boy in Berlin, in under Nazi regime.
And what'd they say?
Oh, they said life was. It's a hard thing to talk about, like it is, because I think a lot of people would have a certain view about how German people were throughout that period. You know, I've got copies of my grandfather's swimming certificates from the 30s and the 40s when he was a boy, saying Heinz and Helga, very German, very German, Howie.
Surely they're just ate strudel and bratwurst all day, every day.
Very German.
She's a real straight German operation.
Yeah, that's
that is.
It. those names might have been adjusted for life in Australia. I'm not sure, but Heinz and Helga. And I've got copies of my grandfather's swimming certificates, and it's, to certify that Heinz Rehbock can swim for 15 minutes or tread water for 15 minutes. And it's like a run-of-the-mill swimming certificate, apart from the giant great eagle and swastika emblazoned over the top of his swimming certificate.
Wow.
So you just look at that stuff and it's so jarring, and you think, how can life have been normal? But for them, the war was like, it was not even something that they were really, I guess, exposed to until they were, when Berlin obviously fell, what was that, in the mid-40s.
Yep.
So I mean, some of the stories are pretty harrowing and horrific, and a lot of it didn't make my book because it just wasn't, like, probably appropriate. But you know, real stories of survival, in Berlin, the very last days of the war, my grandmother's father took up arms as part of the Volkssturm, which was the People's Army against the invading forces, and was killed on the last day of the war. And so, all of these little occurrences that they'd spoken about that I'd never even heard before, right the way through to sort of the mid-50s, when I'm assuming life in, post-World War II Berlin wasn't that great. They were on the West, which was, clearly,
how random is that?
The more preferable site.
Random is that, where the wall is built?
That's it. Dictates, like, I mean, if they were on the east,
you're not playing for St Kilda.
Well, I'm probably not here.
No.
Yeah. Well,
Saints fans
I'm
are
not.
Going, oh, heavens above.
Oh gosh, and Jack and Tigers fans are everywhere.
So they left. They left Germany. To come to Australia.
And
with
no idea about
the place.
And my grandfather came and worked on the hydro scheme.
Right.
Yeah, which a lot of Europeans did.
Okay.
Sort of
Tasmania.
Post-war, yeah. So settled in Tassie, and four boys. My father's, Joe's the oldest, was born in Berlin, and then Ray and Chris, who's Jack's dad, and Peter, and they've been there ever since.
Tell me about Tassie. We'll get to the Tassie team, but both my parents grew up in Tasmania. Neither were born there, so we've had a few discussions about Tassie. But tell me about Orford.
Yeah.
Shacks, and being a young bloke in Tassie before you made the move to the Gold Coast. But a lot of people, we probably shouldn't give this away, a lot of people don't understand, that haven't been to Tassie. It amazes me how many Australians and international tourists don't go there, how good a joint Tasmania is.
Yeah. It's cool.
We probably shouldn't pump
keep
it, up
it that
too
way, mate. You're going to cost everyone, because it's the bloody best secret in the world.
It is.
It's so good. Like, it's almost caught in a bit of a time warp, I think, and that's what makes it special. So growing up, you don't know what you don't know. So growing up, it's life and it's normal. Probably only now that I've had the opportunity to spend time on the mainland of Australia, live in Queensland, live in Melbourne, travel all around the world, that you actually realise what a special place it is. I mean, it's the only place really that I'm comfortable to let my boys get on their bikes in the morning. This is on the east coast of Tassie.
Mm.
Say, see you later, and I'm not that concerned for their safety. You know, I say that, obviously as a responsible father, you're always concerned, but they can't really find too much trouble. Now,
which is a rarity.
It's rare. Like, there's no way I'm saying, boys, go for your life, jump on your bikes and off you go in Melbourne. Not a chance. It's those little things, the fact that it is still caught in that bit of a time warp. Like, people make the jokes, but I love that you, everywhere you go, you see someone you know. Like it's a pretty special thing. That is outside of small country towns, but that's sort of the feel, I think, for the whole joint.
It is.
That it is that country town feel for an entire state. And the natural beauty that is overlaid over all of that, the East Coast where our shack is, with holiday homes down there,
and
people
that's
call shacks.
That's another thing about Tassie. Their holiday home is called a shack.
It's called a shack.
Very Tasmanian-centric term.
Yeah, it is. So I started saying that here and people looked at me sideways. I didn't really... And when I say shack, it's a house. I mean, it's not.
But it's called a shack.
Apart,
it's in Victoria, it's your holiday house down in the Nepean Peninsula or past Frankston or down where I live. That's your holiday house. But in Tassie, it's the shack. And it's often at Orford.
And it's days spent fishing, walking, riding bikes, out on the water, on the beach, just doing real stuff, which is like we've got no internet there. We've got a TV with just, you know, the dodgy free-to-air connection, no smart, nothing. It's just real. And it's so hard to manufacture that for your kids now.
Yes, it is.
So we get down there and I've done the trip a lot of times with the boys, get on the Spirit, drive the car on, do the trip. We've got all the gear down there and then we're just there and we sit and we just do stuff that you can't really recreate anywhere else. Not in a way where I've got on my mum's side. So we spoke about the German side, and on mum's side we've got seven generations of history there. So my boys are doing the same things that I did on the same jetty. You know, catching little brim and catching little salmon off the same jetty that I did, that my mum did. My grandmother did.
Isn't that great?
It's awesome. It's very, unless you're, and I say this respectfully, unless you're probably an Indigenous Australian, I don't think many families would have like seven generations of history in one place like that.
No, absolutely.
So it's special.
Back to Rui shortly. Next up on the Howie Games, a fella I'd never met before until sitting down with him a couple of weeks ago, tennis player Tanasi Kokkinakis. And what a lovely chap he is. He's really friendly, just a good, fun dude. Really impressive bloke. Now, Tanasi talks about the serious commitment required as a junior to make it to the pro ranks, the physical and mental pain of injury. He takes us behind the scenes of the ATP Tour, which is fascinating. He talks about the Australian Open doubles crown with his great mate Nick Kyrgios, which blew right up, if you remember, when they knocked over the number one seeded Croatians, who were not happy Jan.
Nick hit a second serve one time and like it was an ace on a big point, and he did like a big ball celebration, meaning like it was a clutch serve. Anyway, we end up winning the match, whatever. I'm like, Nick, let's go to the gym, you know, we're professionals, let's go stretch and warm down. Probably the first time we've ever done that after a doubles match, by the way. We get in there and I'm on the first through the door, and the Croatians fitness trainer has a foam roller and he's just smashing it up against a pole, like heaps hard. And I was like, holy fuck. I thought he was kind of joking. And I was like, oh, dude, he's going to lay into his players. Watch this. Anyway, he turns around and just beelines for us. I'm like, oh shit, what's going on here? And he had these big veneers on as well. So it's just, I don't know.
On his chompers?
Yeah, he had big chompers. So, and he was like sweating and like, saliva was like coming and spitting out. And he's like, you think you have big balls now? And I was like, who, me or Nick? Like, which one's got big balls? I was like, oh no, this is outrageous. And he kept coming. He got closer and closer. Like, no, show us your big balls. We do it outside. Show us your big balls. I was like, oh God, what's going on here? Like, I'm like, this isn't UFC. Like, what are we watching here?
That's Tanasi Kokkinakis, who I'm a big rap for after talking with him. Next up on the show. Let's get back to Rui.
A frequent listeners to the show know that I've got two kids, and the one that's most invested in the guest ask a question.
Right.
You get the big penguin. His name is Mac, but he rolls the big penguin. Why Rui? Who gave you the name Rui?
It was actually my uncle's nickname.
Your uncle's nickname?
Uncle Peter.
He was Rui.
He was Rui. And then when I went to Southport, I played footy at Broadbeach, and I went to Southport as a 16-year-old and was doing a drill, and all of these blokes were like, Rui, Rui. And I'm like, I said to someone, who's Rui? And they said, oh,
it's you.
Dickhead, it's you.
All right, Rui, you get the question from the big penguin. It's related to exactly what we're talking about.
Hey, Nick, big penguin here. My dad told me that you have a shack in Orford and you go fishing there all the time. That sounds really cool. And he also said you're a gun fisherman, which is really cool as well. I like fishing heaps. I haven't been fishing in Orford though, but I have been fishing in Tasmania with my grandpa because he lives in Hobart. And we were catching heaps of fish, and then we realised that it was like a restricted no fish catching area, so we let all the fish back. But what I want to know is, what fish do you catch at Orford? And can we go together?
I thought he was angling on the on the way through. There was just an angle. I was picking it up. I was thinking BP wants to come fishing.
He was angling to go angling.
Yeah,
he's obsessed by it.
Yeah, that's great. How good fishing? How good is fishing?
Well, the life you describe, he's lucky enough to be living where we live down the coast in Victoria.
And I've seen pictures, and it looks like that.
Yes.
And it's great. So,
but he wants to know what you catch.
Well, first thing is, absolutely, the place sits there. You can use it whenever you like. And if I'm there and you want to come down and bring the BP, even better, we'll have a blast. What do we catch? I mean, we catch a lot of flathead because it's like everywhere and it's easy to catch and the boys can catch it. It's easy to cook. It's easy to clean. How good's the technique where you keep this, keep that little bit and then you just rip the flesh away from the skin and the skin holds all the bones. Perfect.
My grandfather used to tell me, because we'd go fishing off Tinderbox where he was, in his tinny, exactly what you're saying, and now my son does it with my dad. He said, we can fish as long as you want and we can catch as many flathead as you want, but when we get to shore, you have to sit there the whole time while I clean them.
Yeah, none of this running off business.
No, so you knew the more fish in the fish box was more fun, but it was longer at the other end of the day.
Yeah,
because
gotcha.
they take a minute and a half to fill it, and if you've got 100 of them, all of a sudden you're there for 2 hours.
Yeah, or 40 seconds if you sort of know what you're doing.
Okay, Richard Howard needed to sharpen up a bit then, old Grandpa.
You need some sharper knives, I think, Grandpa. Come on. So it's not too bad because we bring them in and then we clean them on the jetty, which is out in the river. So you little Prosser River and then opens up, you know what Orford's like, opens up into the big Oyster Bay there. And when we come in and clean them, into the water, big rays come in around the jetty, little brim, and so the boys just sit there and fish off the jetty after we've been fishing. So they enjoy that. So we catch a lot of flathead. We dive a bit, so dive for crays and for abs, and scallop season just opened up. So occasionally,
do you dive in winter? Do you dive in winter?
I have, yeah. Big thick suit.
Yeah.
Obviously more enjoy. Like it's an undertaking in winter.
Yes.
I wouldn't say everything
in Tasmania is an undertaking in winter.
I wouldn't say it's enjoyable on the way back in when you're cold and wet and have no fish. It's awesome. Like I went through a period of taking the first year boys from St Kilda down every year, and so take them down.
Have pictures in your book about
have a weekend. So we'd go down. We go up to the Spring Bay Hotel on the Friday night, have a steak, have a few beers, get up, fish all day Saturday, and then fly home on the Sunday, and just, I think those experiences probably made or reaffirmed to me even more just how special this place is, a place that I've grown up. But you bring the boys down and some of them have never held a fishing rod before.
Yes.
And so here's this thing you take for granted and, you know, hunt together and you think, yeah, it's great. But when you see it through their eyes or you see it now through your kids' eyes, this is actually something that is, you know, very, very special.
Little known fact about Tassie.
What do you got?
Well, I presume it must be the case. So the last time I was in Orford, we were heading towards Bishanoe and Swansea, where I actually proposed to my wife, but that's a story
for
another day. Yeah, but through Orford, she was driving. Her name is Erica, but for the purpose of this story, we'll call her Max Verstappen, because she was speeding through Orford.
Oh.
An old mate with a radar got her, pulled her over and said, you know, it was a 50. She thought it was a 60. You were doing 62. And then said, show me your license. And it's a Victorian. And the wonderful police person said, basically, there's a law in Tasmania, I've never checked this out, that if you're a non-Tasmanian resident, you get like a monopoly one get out of jail free.
That can't be true.
Well, that's what they said.
You know what? I reckon I know who the cop was.
Really?
He's just, oh, I reckon it was probably Buck, the local Orford.
Might have been.
I reckon it was Buck. I reckon it was the local Orford cop, and he's just
and
a beauty.
I haven't put him in it.
You don't want to speed through there.
Well,
that Tasman Highway along the Prosser River there, it's paradise, they call
That's
it, through
where
that
it
part.
Was, right next to the river.
It is like driving along the coast of Europe somewhere,
yes,
where it's the cliff and then nothing.
But he was also, he was right.
And he let her off.
Well, he was in someone's typical country setup. He's parked in someone's driveway. You know when they park in someone's driveway? Anyway, so I think.
So she got off.
Yeah, I think that's a Tasmanian rule. I think that's, now, footy. We're talking about performance now. I dog-eared your page on one spot in this book, on page 74. And you're talking about winning and losing.
Yep.
Okay. Before I preface this, I'll say the last time I saw you, you said, I said, I'll see you Thursday for the podcast. And you said, oh, yeah, what do I need to do to prepare? And I'm like, mate, you don't need to prepare anything. And that will give people an insight into your mind. I'm saying, you just need to write. And you said, but I need to, no, you don't need to prepare anything.
Right.
So we'll get to preparation. You're talking about winning and losing. This blew me away. Bear with me. This is Nick Revolt's book, Revolt, The Things That Make Us. It's not just about losing. It's measuring so much of your self-worth by how you do things and feeling inadequate when you haven't done something as well as you know you could have. I've had games where we've won and I've played okay, but I might have shanked a shot at goal or made some other basic mistake. This is the bit that really got to me, and I thought, how'd you do this for 17 years? That night, I wouldn't be able to sleep. It made me feel dirty. Dirty is an interesting adjective there. It made me feel dirty, and I'd want to keep talking about it until someone said, don't worry about it, you still played well. I'd search for something to help me cleanse. The whole week, I'd just feel dirty. That is an extraordinary paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to hear that back now that you're out of the game? The whole week, I just feel dirty. Heavens above.
Yeah. Those that know me well, that were close to me through my career, would agree.
Right.
Like they would see it. And at times that made me hard to be around. So what do I think now when I hear it? I think I can feel it. I can still feel that feeling or emotion, but I'm so glad that I'm not there anymore.
Dirty. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a strange adjective.
Yeah.
So Grant Hackett on this show once said to me, and it stuck in my mind like that did, I asked him, how did you feel about your silver and bronze medals? And he said they were disgusting.
Yeah.
And it's the same style of adjective that you've used, dirty.
Mm. That's how I felt. And so that's why I was so wound up all the time, particularly in the lead up to games, was because I felt like every time I took the field, and this was true for my last game. Every time I went on the field, it was an opportunity to either enhance my reputation or diminish my reputation, which is silly. Like, it's nonsensical, because if you've done something for 15 years really well, then one game's not going to really change the way people think about you. But in my mind, that's where I went. So I used to do this thing where I would, like, before I was going to the game, and I would just go into a zone that was completely subconscious. I didn't even know I was doing it, but every week I would brush my teeth, and I had like a game day brush my teeth mode where, like Kath would say, would you take it easy? You're going to pop a tooth out, or your gums are going to start bleeding. Cause I would just start brushing my teeth in the most aggressive manner, and I didn't even realize I was doing it. And this was my very last game that I played.
So you're still doing it at that point?
I knew it was my last game. I knew I was driving to the MCG. We couldn't play finals. This is it. This is your last game. And I was still doing it. And I remember having the conversation and being in the shower, brushing my teeth and saying, she was like, it's your last game. Can't you just go and relax? I'm like, you would think, but I just can't. And so right through to my last game, every time I went out, it was an opportunity to potentially chip away at what people thought of you, which is crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And it wasn't just catastrophic failure, like losing a grand final, that dictated that. It was the most simple things within a game of football that, if, you know, you might have kicked three or four and taken 10 marks and had a good day, but if I had a couple of moments where I thought, geez, I didn't do that, like I can't believe I missed that goal. I can't believe I ran in and, you know, went to pass when I should have had, whatever. And I would play it over and over and over. And it would, that would dominate the way I reflected rather than the, you know, the other good things that had occurred or the fact that we'd won. And so I, particularly in a leadership position, I had to be really careful to sort of internalize a lot of that stuff. I mean, like I said, those close to me were able to pick up on it, but it was, yeah, that was just the headspace that I found myself in that I could never shake. Just couldn't, I couldn't shake it for 17 years.
How long after the game finishes, like football moves on very quickly, how long, say your game, you're playing a traditional 2 o'clock game on a Saturday, you finish at 5 o'clock, there's something that's making you feel dirty.
Yeah.
How long till you are cleansed of it?
Probably until the review or until the industry had moved on to the next week.
So that's at least Monday or Tuesday.
Maybe. Yep. Jeez. Yep.
So you're sitting with it that long.
Yeah.
What does it do to you, those feelings internally?
Provide drive, I think. So
this is where we come back. If you weren't like this, would you have been the bloke that I read at the start?
Probably not.
Wow.
Probably not. I piss myself off because I think about all the times that I should have had more fun and I should have just enjoyed the ride more. But then at the same time, I don't want people to sit here and think that I didn't enjoy a lot of aspects of it. But the anxiety around performance was something that was really just something to get through. It was not, I didn't enjoy that part of it. I didn't. Once the ball was bouncing, I was in the throes of the game and I knew I had a bloke's number, or I knew if I went on a long searching lead that the guy was going to, like, that was a feeling that I just loved and craved, to know that you had the game under control, and that sense of sort of dominance in a game was just awesome. It was such an amazing feeling, and I miss that.
Hold that thought for a sec. When did this feeling of that I described, at what age did it start? Was it junior footy, or was it when you started playing?
I think I was always a pretty nervous, anxious sort of kid with playing sport. This is sad, Howie. So my oldest boy, James, had his first game of footy the other week, and he came in the night before and he said, "Oh, my wrist is a bit sore. I don't think I can play tomorrow."
Before his first game.
Yeah. His wrist is fine. But I just looked at that and I just thought, oh no, he's exactly the same. Exactly the same. It'll serve him well in some respects, but in others, I just wish he didn't have to. I wish he could just be more like his Uncle Jack and just
go out and enjoy things at times. The crux of where we've got to now.
Yeah.
As a dad, did you just think, right, this could serve him well, so I'll leave him be?
No.
Or as a dad, did you say, mate?
No. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I just had the conversation that, why? What are you anxious about? And is tell me about your wrist, you know. And then spoke about the game. I mean, because I know it's important to him, and I guess he probably has to deal with something that I didn't. That he's
Nick Riewoldt's son.
That's right, and
Especially not to point too big a point on it, but he's aware. Now.
You know,
Absolutely.
He's aware, and his uncle still plays, and I'm on the TV working with you, and so that's something I never had to deal with, but just had the conversation about enjoyment. Really, yep. That's what I want. I don't care whether he gets a kick or he doesn't. I just want him to enjoy it.
For those that, and I only discovered this last week when you showed me some photos, we don't need to name the team, et cetera, but just tell me, because you were filling in as assistant. So you're assistant coach in game one. Who's the main? Just so people get an idea what they're coming up against if they play against your mob in the coaching box. You were assistant coach, and the main
runner,
coach?
The runner. Yeah, Stewie Lowe.
So you've got Riewoldt and you've got Lowe. I want to know when Plugger's taking over the forward line.
Yeah, we might have to get him down. Yeah, we've got Stevie Baker. He's coaching the Taggers.
I found that extraordinary. Something else I didn't know in the book. So I got to your place the other day, and it filled me with joy. Nick, that on the beautiful front tree, I don't know what type of tree it is, lovely big tree that spreads a big elm over the house, there is a ball strung up in a stocking. And I laughed and I immediately said, mate, I'm pumped your young blokes like cricket already, that they're out here, because the young, the big penguins got it off the veranda at home. So I thought, I'm going to really enjoy his kids because they like cricket. And then you said to me,
no, it's mine.
I loved it. Oh. That you've got the old school ball in the stocking.
It's looking a bit weathered too.
And you go out there and you hit it.
Yeah, well, I'm a proper cricket nuffy.
Which we need to talk about. I didn't know that before the book.
I love it. I love it. And so once footy finished, I right the way through junior cricket and then playing cricket and footy and a bit of the juggle.
Just on junior cricket, left arm, from what I'm reading in the book, Mitch Johnson style, big in swingers, but a very handy cricketer.
Not Mitch Johnson style pace, but I could but I could hoop it around a bit, Howie. I could get him just thinking that it was going to go straight across the line for a right-hander, and the last second it just come back in. A lot of LBs, lot of poles are getting them bowled. Yeah, I loved it. Loved it. I wanted to be a cricketer.
Yep.
I wanted to play cricket. I was handy enough. So, made state representative teams, could bowl, could bat okay. And in the end, I mean, this is pre IPL days. This is back when, if you probably weren't in the best 12 cricketers in the country, you don't really make a living out of it. And, I've been through sort of Pace Australia stuff and been up to the camps at Allan Border Oval and to the indoor nets at the Gabba, and Mitchell Johnson coming through and seeing what those guys could do. So it was pretty clear to me that ability-wise, I wasn't at that level, but loved it nonetheless. And really footy came late for me. I was a late developer physically and a late developer from a football point of view. So under 15s, I didn't make the Gold Coast footy team.
Did you not?
Didn't make the Gold Coast team. And then so next year, and then bottom age under 18, I only got a late call up to the Queensland team because Robbie Copeland rolled his ankle a week before the carnival.
Brisbane Lions
premiership player. And so I got a late call up to the national carnival to play for Queensland as a bottom age guy, and ended up playing on a Tassie guy in the first game. Because I could run. They put me on this guy. Danny Roach was his name. And he went first. Ended up being a first round pick to Collingwood that year as a top age guy, and played really well. And that was sort of it. That was the moment where, actually, there was another moment where I played in a premiership that year for Southport reserves team in the Queensland AFL. And the next day was the Queensland under 17 tryouts. Probable
for cricket.
Possible type scenario for cricket.
And the Southport boys go pretty hard after a premiership.
Well, the premiership cup ended up in the fire, in the bonfire, Howie. And there was we're at Southport, so we had a lot of resources, and they actually ended up locking they had a cool truck that they'd driven down onto the oval for us. It was filled with all the alcohol. Well, a couple of boys went and got sledgies and knocked the hinges off the doors to the truck so it got pretty wild. And my old man came and picked me up from Southport at 7 a.m. and we drove up
For
the cricket trials to Allan Border Oval. And so I got thrown a ball to open the bowling and I had to go cross seam because I just had no idea where it was going. I think my first four deliveries were all leg side wides. One of the guys came back to me and said, mate, what's happening to those beautiful in-swingers? I said, well, I could see three batsmen. So that was the end of my cricket career. And that was pretty much the last game of cricket I played until
post-cricket. Well, on that, I have been lucky enough to see you in a couple of versions of cricket that both stick with me fondly. A mutual friend of ours, Adam White, organises a media game. And we had a bat together, that's probably last year.
Yeah.
And I think you were in and I came out, and it's like this is again your level of competitiveness. We're playing against, some
very, very good cricketers.
MC, he was a very good cricketer, generally aged over 55, but very good. And you were smacking them everywhere and I can't hit it off the square. And I came out and there's maybe four overs to go. And the first thing you said to me, oh, this is going to be fun. Just don't throw your wicket away. And I'm thinking, Right, I feel like it's a test match. But I enjoy batting with you. But more than that, one of my fondest broadcasting memories was the bushfire match at Junction Oval. Junction Oval in Melbourne, Victoria, Australia is your venue for what is going to be a wonderful afternoon's entertainment. This is The Big Appeal. Elise Perry bowled to Tendulkar, Wazim Akram, like just, and Gilly and Punter, and you were playing in that game. Mm. I think you took the new ball.
First change.
Yeah. Who'd you get to bowl to?
Did you? Well, I bowled to Haydos.
Yes.
Haydos, listen to yes. me. I bowled to Matthew Hayden.
Yes. Age has been patient. 9 off 10. Can he load up the big Queenslander? Straight back to Freeman. Brilliant work. They're going upstairs. Gilly, you're out the middle. What are your initial thoughts?
I like it. Pretty good. Pretty good. Mind you, we might be better keeping Hayden in the way he's hitting
them. Oh, no.
Jeez. I hope this goes against us, this decision.
Quite handy. Nick Riewoldt with ball in hand.
And that was great. And then I got another opportunity to have a bowl, which I couldn't believe. I thought, this is perfect. I bowled to Matthew Hayden. I bowled to Justin Langer. I bowled to Ricky Ponting. And then the Prince was having a bat. And Gilly said, hey, have one more. I could not believe it. So I bowled to VC Lara. And, I mean, I actually love the fact that he hit me for four over cover, one bounce over the rope.
I remember it clearly.
Riewoldt living his dream, bowling to Brian Lara, who just crunches him through the covers, and another boundary for Lara.
It was just the most ridiculous moment. And I was trying to play it cool because it was all cricketers.
Yes.
Apart from myself and Hodgie and
Cam Smith.
That's right.
And so Hodgie and I were having we were just having these little moments where we just kept looking at each other going, is this actually happening? Like, is this for real? And he's a proper cricket head too. Wazim Akram. I mean, what an incredible bloke.
And you were in I reckon you scored a cricket bat somehow out of it, maybe from Gilly.
So I hung around.
I remember seeing you in the rooms surrounded by cricketers and just that I love the adoration on your face.
Yeah.
It's probably the best way I can describe it.
I was a kid, Howard. Yeah, and I was proper starstruck, which probably hasn't happened that many times in my life because you just don't get to meet your heroes like this, particularly international ones like Tendulkar and Lara, Wazim Akram, these guys that when you're a kid, you would never anticipate, probably the same for you. You would never anticipate having these opportunities. And it was really only through Warnie that I had the opportunity because he was putting it together and then he had to go overseas.
Yeah,
something
he did.
With the
he was
UN,
in London.
I think it was. Yeah. And it was the net session was great. That from a cricketing point of view, that was the most enjoyable because just to stand there and watch the guys and have a bat, like I waited to see which net Binger was going to bowl in before Binger. Listen to
it's
me,
like
would you?
It's like I'm mates. In the early 2000s.
Like I'm mates of them. What a lunatic! Oh, pull up.
I like it. So, that's the type of blokes they are. They're such approachable blokes.
Yeah,
they very quickly
they
become
rippers.
Binger and Warnie and Gilly and Punter, don't they?
They do. And it was the most incredible day for a kid that loved his cricket so much to be able to sit in the dressing rooms afterwards where they pulled the Eskies in. It felt like we were 3-0 up in the Ashes. And sitting around just having a chat. I did hear at one stage Matthew Hayden talking to Punter, and I could tell he was talking about, he was like, oh, yeah, footy. Was he any good? I had no clue, which was kind of good as well. And ended up kicking. I outstayed my welcome, no doubt, because they all went back to the hotel. I jumped on the bus.
Still
dagging. I went back to the hotel with them. I was happy to keep hanging out. And mate, it was like looking back, just one of the great moments.
Whose bat did you nick?
Gillies.
Gillies.
Yeah.
Gillies.
And gloves.
Yeah.
Left-hander. Doesn't matter. I'm still worn them.
Because you need them on the elm tree at home.
Yeah, but the thumb, the thumb guard on the wrong hand, it just doesn't work for me. But
the other thing I remember, I should have mentioned it, on that social game we had where you told me make sure I didn't throw my wicket away, you bowled. I think you might have got through 4 or 5 overs. And then I remember you saying, my knees will be no good tomorrow. And then I started bowling. And I'd got through just about enough overs and the game was getting tight. And I remember you saying to Adam White, the skipper, mate, I better come back on. We can win this. And I'm thinking, You just hope he's not going to be able to walk tomorrow. And you hobbled up there, but then you got through. And that is when I realised it comes back to that competitiveness. You still wanted to get there and win the game. It's a curse and a blessing, mate.
It's a curse and a blessing. It absolutely is.
Because you said, no, my knees are no good. And then,
they weren't. And they're not. They're horrific. Well, one horrific knee.
That's the end of Nick Revolt Part A. See you for the second half on Part B.
Listener.